The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's Genjo Koan. When first one seeks the real, one separates far from its environs. When one has transmitted the real to oneself, one is the original self at that moment. So I'm going to begin with these talks throughout the ongoing, this fascicle of Master Dogen's, Genjo Koan. I spoke about this a little bit earlier at the opening. First, I wanted to mention that during the weekend, with the this introductory weekend, a number of you and Dokusan brought up your Zazen at home as being a little spotty, inconsistent. And so I thought I'd just say something about that. It's not uncommon. It's much easier, generally speaking, to sit when you're with other people. At home, there are a lot of things pulling. And that oftentimes I've seen people, some people, when things are going difficult in their lives, and they go to the cushion, and then when things ease up, they'll move away. For other people, it might be just the opposite. When things are easy, they go to the cushion. When things get difficult, they back away. So, you know, what really encourages and strengthens Dharma practice and meditation is some consistency. And so it's good just to sort of try and make that a consistent part of one's practice if you want to be a practitioner. And to just sort of, you know, not make it contingent on how you feel, basically. You know, you just make a decision. I mean, you know, if you have a job that you go to work, you wake up, you don't really feel like going to work. Most days you probably go to work. You know, we do things a lot of times because if we don't do them, the consequences of that is significant enough that it helps us to sort of move through whatever the obstacle may be. Dharma practice in many ways is more subtle. It's more inward, more, you know, unmeasurable. And so it's easier to sort of let that come and go depending on how the winds are blowing. And so then that kind of becomes what the practice is. You know, it's sort of determined by things that are impermanent and that come and go. And so when we develop a more consistent practice, it's not just that we're sitting more consistently, it means that we're actually reckoning with and meeting those aspects, those wily and sort of unpredictable and fluctuating aspects of ourself. And in developing more consistency, we're moving through some of those things and gaining confidence and stability. So, such an encouragement. You know, and having some flexibility, I think of in terms of having, you know, commitment or intention or discipline to sit regularly, and then flexibility. You know, something comes up, you can't sit today. Fine. So then, you know, the next day you come back to it. So there's not any flexibility, then it becomes rigid. But if there's too much flexibility, then sometimes we just don't get to the cushion. So I wanted to start with that passage, which is further down than we're starting just at the beginning of the Genjo Koan this morning, because it's just so true. When first one seeks the real, we separate ourselves far from its environment, right? Because we think it's somewhere else. Someone's got it, it's somewhere else, it's on top of a mountain, it's in the monastery, it's in a book. Because if it wasn't separate from this person seeking, then why wouldn't I already be experiencing the fruit of that? Why wouldn't my life be endowed with the wisdom if I already possess it? And yet what we see, as Dogen says, when we realized what we are seeking, when it becomes our own to experience, then we realize we have never been apart from it, ever. So the theme of the Ango is the way of everyday life, which is a translation of Genjo Koan, manifesting absolute reality. In another fascicle, Dogen says, those who regard the worldly affairs as a hindrance to Buddha Dharma think only that there is no Buddha Dharma in this secular world. They don't yet understand that there is no secular world in Buddha Dharma. They're not two different worlds. And so the way of everyday life is true no matter what life you're living, no matter where we are. And that's perhaps one of the most challenging things to see and practice. It's even challenging to just have faith in that, right? In a way, it's one of the things that gives a monastery power, is the idea that there's something special happening here, and there is, by the way. But we endow a kind of specialness. And when we endow it here, we leave it out, apart from the place that we have come from to get here. And so really seeing that merging, and this is what Dogen is speaking about in this first section of the Genjo Koan. And I was thinking about it because I'd set out to sort of work through this fascicle, and this is the first day, and it's an introduction. I wouldn't normally choose such a deep teaching, I would say, or a more complex teaching for this for the end of this retreat, but that's how the chips fell. So I hope it is helpful. When all dharmas are Buddha Dharma, Dogen begins, there is enlightenment and delusion, practice, life and death, Buddhas and creatures. When the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there's no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, no death. The Buddha way, however, transcends being and non-being. Therefore, there's life and death, delusion and enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment and weeds spring up with our aversion. Mizumi Roshi in his commentary says, the subject of these first three sentences is our most important concern. So the very first lines of this very powerful teaching of Master Dogen's, which was written for a lay practitioner, a lay student of the Dogen's, by the way, is really encapsulating the whole of the teachings, the whole of Dharma, the whole of the path. So it's quite a way to begin. And so he says, to realize this subject, this true self, is the real intention of our practice. As a matter of fact, in Master Dogen's writings, the words in this passage, the words we and I are never used. He never says, when all dharmas are Buddha dharmas, for me there's enlightenment and delusion. Or for us. He says he doesn't refer to I and we. He simply says, when all dharmas are Buddha Dharma. To really understand Buddha Dharma, we have to have insight and realize this I, the sense of self, and become aware of our true nature, who we really are. When all dharmas are Buddha Dharma, there's enlightenment and delusion, practice, life and death, Buddhas and creatures, dualities, opposites. Dharmas here means all mental and physical phenomena. Anything and everything you can think, everything and anything you can touch with any of your senses. Everything you call yourself and what belongs to you, everything that you call not yourself and what doesn't belong to you. This is dharmas. When all dharmas are Buddha dharmas, Buddha dharma in this case doesn't just mean dharma as taught by the Buddha, but dharmas as realized. Directly, when all things exist in their own Dharma state, when we realize that all things exist already in a state of completion, of perfection, of totality, of peace. That's the nature of everything in the universe, including every aspect of ourselves. And of course, this raises the great question, if that's true, why aren't we all living like that? Here in Buddha Dharma, there's no right and wrong, high or low, better or worse. There's no yesterday or tomorrow. There's no me, there's no you. In any absolute sense, standing by itself, existing by itself, having its own power, the Buddha realized if we look, If anybody looks, you don't have to be a Buddhist practitioner, if anybody looks with an unconditioned eye, in other words, an unbiased eye, a clear eye, we will never find anything that exists in any intrinsic, inherent, independent way. And yet, the habit of mind, our habit energies, are impulsive. Right? We react. Somebody says something, we experience something without trying, without asking. We open our eyes and we look and we see. It seems like an objective world out there. We recognize it, we name it, we judge it, we like it, we don't like it. We choose it, we reject it. That's the impulsive mind. And the Buddha said that mind is never going to be really reliable. You can never really rely on it. Rely on it in the sense of bringing us closer to what is true. It will always disappoint us. We will always be disappointed. Because it's based in a view of the world and a view of ourselves that has some fundamental untruths. Mazuma Roshi said, the usual way of understanding these first three lines is to see them as a progression. From affirmation, just recognizing the things of the world and beginning to see them as aspects of teachings, what the teachings are pointing to, the phenomenal world, self and other, and then to a negation, right? And negation here means just a non-grasping, a complete non-grasping of trying to find any fixed, permanent place to rest, to rely on, that will not disappoint us, that will give us some lasting, ultimate sense of peace and stability. And then transcendence. And Mazumi says, according to this interpretation, the first sentence describes our discriminating awareness before enlightenment. The second, the first experience of unity, emptiness. And the third, the realm of subtle differences, non-differentiation. But if we appreciate it this way, then we really lose Master Dogen's intent. Actually, each sense is saying the same thing from different perspectives. When all dharmas are Buddha dharma. And so many of the commentaries take up this first word, when. What is the time of this when? Right? When all dharmas are Buddha dharma. So we can study the teachings, we can understand words like dharma, like Buddha, like Buddha dharma, like enlightenment and delusion. And that's important. That's an important part of our training. That's why we have Buddha study as a part of our training. We can't, you know, if we read the teachings, we read the sutras, we listen to a teaching and we hear these words and we just sort of gloss, you know, our best guess, our best sense of what it means, that's not going to be very helpful because these words have very particular meaning in Buddhism. And so, and we have to be beware of how those words are used in popular culture online and, you know, on Reddit or whatever, you know, and really understand what did the Buddha mean? What does the Dharma mean when the Dharma says Dharma? And so when we can understand these things, but here this line is saying when all Dharmas are Buddha Dharmas, not just in our understanding, but in our direct experience. And that's why this whole weekend has been a practice-based weekend, right? And so think about it. There's instruction in Zazen, opening words, there are talks on different aspects of training, and all of that is sort of interspersed with practice of doing those very things, bringing our own bodies and minds to the actual thing itself. To move towards that moment of when. And that when is always now. It's never any other time. But it's the time of when all dharmas are Buddha dharma. And even to say are creates a sense of being. Right? To be is to be. To be is to have isness, to be something, to be this, not that. It's so our language is just, you know, sort of grounded in the sense of self, right? I mean, we made it up, right? It's our language. All of them are our languages. And so, of course, they're going to come from human minds and a human mind that sees the world in certain terms of self. And so to be, right, that very significant verb in our language. And so to realize that in that are, when all dharmas are Buddha dharmas, when they are Buddha dharmas, is to realize that there is no isness, no thingness. And so that's why we practice letting all the ideas that solidify and reify and objectify and make certain and predictable, and we, all of those thoughts and those impulses, we just see them and just let them drop. Let them rest. Let them drop back so that we can then enter into one moment of here, now, of when. When? Now. Where? Here. So when we sit, the Buddha said, we too do not need to bring in a sense of I or mine. So when we're sitting, we don't need to sit and moment after moment thinking, I am doing zazen, I am sitting, I am aware, I am letting go, this is my practice, this belongs to me. Not only do we not need to do those things, those thoughts are not going to help us because it's continuing to bring forth this idea. Rather, there's just breath. There's just awareness. There's letting go. There's zazen. Before that, before this when, there is enlightenment and delusion. There's practice. There's life and death. There's Buddhas and creatures. But we get tangled in them. We get caught in them. We get caught in our ideas of them. We get caught in terms of what is its relationship to me. And so Buddhism has not just a built-in, but a very explicit caution that on the one hand, to trust, and if we're going to be a practitioner, to trust it and leap in, right, and engage it fully, because then we are entering into it fully, but without making it yours, a possession, an object, something that you own, something that you are. And of course, training brings all of this to the surface. And so in the moments when we're facing that aspect of self arising through emotions, through thoughts, through wanting or not wanting, liking or not liking, then to bring that question, where am I now? What is this mind? What am I doing with my mind? Because in that tangle, that's not just happening. I am tangling in my mind. So, and do I see that? What have I placed outside of this moment? What have I placed apart? What have I put up as higher or lower? What do I like or dislike? What is the basis of my trust or not trust? These are not abstract questions. There's an early sutra one of the original sutras, where the Buddha is talking to a student, Kachana. And he said, this world, Kachana, for the most part, is dependent upon a dyad, upon the notions of existence and non-existence. But Kachana, for one, seeing the world's origin, its appearing, its arising, as it really is, with clear wisdom, the notion of non-existence of that world just appearing does not occur. And for one, seeing the world's cessation, as it really is, with true wisdom, the notion of existence does not occur. So when something comes into being, we don't think, well, it wasn't here a minute ago, and now it is coming into existence. When something is passing out of existence or passing away, we don't think that it existed and now it's ending. He said, this world is for the most part, he's talking about the human world, is for the most part bound by entanglement and clinging and adherence. But this person, this practitioner, this clear-seeing person, does not approach, does not cling, does not stand upon that involvement, does not make a home in it, does not dwell in it, does not try and take refuge in it, does not try and make that a reliable basis for a life. Not a clinging, not a mental standpoint, not adherence, not a tendency, not a place to call myself. They are not perplexed, and they do not doubt that what arises is just dukkha, arising, suffering arising. Whatever arises, it has the potential for my clinging, for my grasping, for my loving and hating, and in that for my confusion, my pain. They are not perplexed by that. All exists, Kachana, this is one extreme. All does not exist, this is the other extreme. Not having approached both these extremes, in other words, not taking refuge in either of those extremes, the Buddha teaches the Dharma by the middle way, the middle path. And that can be spoken of in many different ways, but this is sort of the fundamental, because it comes back to being, is. Does everything exist as it is? A thing, an object, something objective, permanent? Or is everything utterly non-existent? And the Buddha said either of those are paths to just ongoing, unending trial and tribulation. He said there is a middle path. And so we speak of the teachings, the practice, and the training and so on as hewing close, staying with, training in that middle path. But the middle path is just the way the world is. Living other living things, mountains, rivers, they don't wander from one extreme to another. Only in the human realm. And so in that way, we are literally reclaiming, returning, in a sense, without a step, our basic nature. So Dogen says, then when the 10,000 things are without self, are not self, there's no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, no death. Yes, Sayadaw Roshi in his commentary said, so here the glare of enlightenment can become gradually tempered before something was shining. So if we think, so there's a, I mean, this is where Buddhism is so devoted, so dedicated to actually liberating ourselves, that it cautions us against liberation itself. Be careful. That on the path of liberation, we not turn in our mind liberation into something, just a new version of an old thing. And so the shine, the glare, the attachment, the stink of enlightenment, right? When somebody becomes holy, self-righteous. And so think of the moon, bright, clear, full moon. So when we begin, it's hidden in clouds, mostly, largely, right? It's hard to see. The light is dimmed. And then we realize that nothing is actually obstructing us. Nothing has that power outside of ourselves. And so it's like realizing the bright, clear sky with no clouds, no moon, no sky. Nothing exists independently. In the beginning, everything seems to exist outside of us. You're over there, I'm over here. How can that not just be the way it is? And so the teachings say, yes, that is true, but how, what is the nature of this that exists? How does it exist? What is the nature of its being? In Buddhism, that can be made into a philosophical question, but in Buddhism it is not. It's an existential question. It's a life and death kind of question. It's a house, the house is burning kind of question. Because when we adhere to that sense of self, and that gets stronger and stronger, and then you give that person power, and then you give them more power, they become dangerous. They are dangerous. They create danger. They light the fire. They burn the house down. It's not abstract. Greed, anger, and delusion, we talk about it all the time. Pride and jealousy. They are called poisons for a reason. They poison our system. They make us sick. And when they get stronger and stronger, we become toxic. And the world around us becomes toxic. And so what Buddhism is getting at is not like, it would be nice if you have time, if you can work it in. Wouldn't it be great? It's like, no, actually, life is in peril, right? Within delusion. Fortunately, for most of us, and most of the time, we manage it, you know, well enough. There's a sufficient amount of sanity and groundedness and caring and concern and compassion and love, a sufficient amount of willingness to take responsibility, hold ourselves and each other accountable, forgive. There's enough, right? Could always be more, but there's enough. And it can still all be really based in the sense of, yes, and I am, and you are, and we're not the same, but let's try and make it work, right? Let's not fight. Let's make peace, and let's hope it lasts. It won't, but let's hope. Because the Buddha said, anything you pull together, it's not going to last. It's going to come apart. That's the nature of it. Anything you build is going to come down. I mean, think about it. How long is it going to take to this building? I don't want to be here when it comes down. But it's got to. If stars burn out, then a wooden and stone building has to have a time limit. And so to remedy the glare of enlightenment when the 10,000 things are without self. And that's true all the time. It's not just when it's realized. And so here, any trace of lingering, abiding, holding on, anything to hold on in has fallen away. There's no delusion. There's no enlightenment. No Buddhas, no creatures, no life, no death. No more illusion of something existing or not existing, of being pure or impure. Those are all human mind creations. And they can be extremely helpful, right? We need to be able to say, this is wrong. This is good. We have to be able to do that. But when we do that thinking, there's an absolute good here and an absolute wrong here, then people and places become objects. What happens when people become objects? Read the news. You don't even have to read the news. Just look around. You don't even have to look around. Look inside. We do it to others. We do it to ourselves. To objectify. To make something into an object. Something that is alive. That is whole. That is complete. In this line, Dadarushi used to always ask the question, why did he leave practice out? When all things are without self, there's no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, no death. But he didn't say practice. Why? I'm going to ask that question the way he asked the question. Just ask the question. Consider it. If we build a nest, no matter what it is, no matter what it's made of, even if it's emptiness, even if it's enlightenment, even if it's liberation, even if it's the Dharma, the moment we turn it into something, it starts to become toxic. And so Dogen says the Buddha way transcends being and non-being, is and is not, this and that, you and me. Therefore, there's life and death, delusion, enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. The whole world. Dadarushi used to say, if you let go of everything, what remains? Everything. To transcend is tricky, that word, to go beyond. There is something like that that's happening here. There is. And so it has a place. There is something, a kind of going beyond, but it's not what we think it is. It's not moving from here to there. from delusion to enlightenment. When you let go, what is that actually? I mean, we're practicing all the time. What does it mean to let go? If I'm grasping at this kotz, which was my teacher's, he held it in his hand for years, so it means something to me. Right? It's just a stick, but it means something. Right? If I grasp at this stick, where's the grasping? When I let go of this stick, how do you know if I've let go of it? How do I know if I've let go of it? I can put it over here. I can give it to you. I can still be holding on to it. When grasping, we don't move closer to the thing. When not grasping, we haven't necessarily moved further away. We have not moved further away. Nothing has changed. We haven't gone anywhere. And it's not the same. That fire is cooling. The Buddha way is not bound by or limited to or defined by, which means, so if you think of liberation as bringing ourselves into accord, into alignment, into harmony with the real nature of things, with the what's actually going on here, right? It's like if you're in an orchestra and you're playing an instrument and everybody else is in tune and you're not, it's going to show up. You're going to know it. Other people are going to know it. If you don't know it, they'll let you know, right? That gorgeous piece of music is not going to be gorgeous. It has all the potential. And so to come into harmony, right, if it were only that easy, to come into alignment is to not be discordant, right? And that doesn't mean just follow the rules. I mean, rules can be the most tyrannical of things. In a despotism, rules are the thing, right? But to actually be in accord, to actually be in alignment, means we have to be in alignment with ourselves, in accord, in harmony, not in conflict, not apart. And so that's why we have to practice not fighting, not setting ourselves apart. From what? From your mind, from your thoughts, from your emotion, from your history, from your karma, from all of it. When all dharmas are Buddha dharmas. And it's, you know, it's hard to have faith in. Sometimes it isn't even what we want to believe, that nothing changes. I mean, who would be here if we didn't want something to change? It's all about change. There's nothing but change. But how? How is it changing? And what does change mean? What do we think is changing from what to what? One thing is painful, we want it to go away. The other thing is pleasurable, we want it to stick around. One makes me suffer, one makes me happy. This is the when of everything that I call myself and mine, everything that I don't call myself and not mine. Azuma Roshi said, another way of looking at these lines is to use the analogy of waves and water. This is a traditional image that I think is very nice. He said, seeing reality according to the perspective of the first sentence is like looking at the ocean and you see the waves. There's the ocean and then the wave. All dharmas are Buddha dharma. We are aware the ocean is there, but our attention is on the waves, the various phenomena that make up our lives. In the next sentence, the emphasis is on the water, the ground of being, true nature, emptiness, the absolute. And in the last sentence, we go beyond the duality. Is it waves or is it water? Is it ocean or is it waves? We go beyond that entirely and see them both as one indivisible reality. And that's why it's such a good image, right? Because it's true, right? I mean, nobody would argue, I think, that the waves are not the ocean. Right? It's ludicrous. How can there be unity, one nature, and differentiation? Separate things. And how can those exist at the same moment and be completely in harmony? one reality. He says, all along, of course, we're just looking at the same ocean. It's just our perspective that is changing. And here, it's perspective in the deepest sense. That it's not just a view, but it's coming out of experience. And then Dogen finishes by this passage by saying, nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment, and weeds spring up with our aversion. Weeds often refers to our attachments, the things we cling to. And so here, the moon that was hidden by clouds, and then all of it is dropped away, and now everything returns. The moon is there, but now it's hazy. It's complete, it's whole, it's fully luminous. There's just a little haze. When the mind is undisturbed, things do not offend. And when they don't offend, we experience them differently. They're not as they used to be. And they're not different. How is it when we see each wave as separate from the others? Not only separate from the ocean, but separate from every other wave. This one's bigger. This one's more beautiful. This one's younger. How is it when we see the world that way? Well, have you been reading the news? When we see the world that way, attachments are inevitable, even when we try our best and do live a good life. Someone once asked in this retreat many years ago about delusion. They said, I have the most sweetest, most loving, kind, compassionate grandmother. Is she deluded? And I said, probably. All of those things are true. Delusion isn't a sin. It's not a crime. It's not a mistake. It's just the way we will inevitably see things because our senses convey a sense of inside and outside and a sense of solidity, objectivity, things. And so attachments will be inevitable, but they can be practiced. But we have to want to. We have to want to. That's why each of us here today has brought ourselves here. That's really important. That's why Buddhism generally, most generally, does not try and convert people. Right? If we could just make people care, well, let's do it then. Right? If we could just make people be kind, I'm all for that. But we can't. But how do we encourage? Right? What are skillful means? Well, for many practitioners, just suffering, which covers quite a bit, does it. And not just the suffering, but wanting to be free of that. With the residents, Sangha Breakfast on Friday, I showed an interview with Ken Burns. I said, I feel like if we had national treasures, which at this time we won't and we don't, but we should, he would be a national treasure in my mind. This documentarian who keeps showing us these are key aspects of who we are as a country, as people. And he quoted a passage of Lincoln that I had come across many years ago, and which I liked a lot, so I want to bring that back. And it was actually part of a larger letter I think he was writing. There was a party at his time in the 1850s called the Know-Nothings, and they were xenophobic. They really arose out of an anti-immigrant position. And so he was writing about that, and he said, I am not a know-nothing. They call themselves that because whenever people challenge them, they say, I don't know what's going on. I don't know anything about that. He said, I am not a know-nothing. How could I be? How can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? Our progress in degeneracy appears to me pretty rapid. As a nation, we began by declaring all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. When the know-nothings get controlled, it will read all men are created equal except Negroes, foreigners, Catholics. And when it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty. to Russia, for example, where despotism can be taken pure and without the base alloy of hypocrisy. This balance between liberties and order, some degree of order, structure, right? If you came here and we said, you have Buddha nature, you are utterly free, do whatever you want, right? How would that work? Right? But if there's too much, if it's too rigid, if it's about controlling, that's not liberty. That can't be a path to liberation. Between personal freedoms and what is necessary for a people to be a people, to live together. These tensions that will never go away, that are built into us. And what he made a point of, and others have, is the essential nature for anything that is going to be good, anything that is brought into being that needs, that is, it has to be, have a self-correcting built-in mechanism. It has to be able to reflect back on itself with a critical mind. Is this working? What is our intention? Are we staying close to that intention? Have we wandered away? How do we notice that? How do we correct? If that doesn't exist, then that cannot end up being good. If it has those, but they are not used, it will not be good. Isn't that what we're doing as practitioners? Looking at what, in essence, is perfect and complete, and as Suzuki Roshi said, could use a little work, right? But how to do that from that understanding that you are not broken, I am not broken, so we don't bring that mentality, that paradigm. Brokenness is having a view of something that is solid and fixed and needs to be made into something new, solid and fixed, just better. And so that middle path, right? And in order to live that, what does that require? Ongoing, ceaseless attention, alertness, mindfulness. And that has to be based in something, an ethic, a morality, a clear sense of what is good and not good, what is right and wrong, what is helping and what is not helping, what is cruel and what is kind. And we have to hold ourselves and each other accountable. And when those things are not in operation, there is a sickness. And so when we are sick, right, where there's an illness in our body, we do everything we can with the aspect of our body that is not sick, right, that wants to be well, to try and make ourselves well. At the same time that we can't control it, we can't just say, okay, sickness gone. And that sickness may be so strong that we have to live with it for a while. It may debilitate us. It may take away some of our capacity. That may be temporary, it may be permanent. And that's the reality we live with. While we're trying to do everything we can to move towards health, to move towards goodness, to move towards our life as a human, awakened, and potentially enlightened being. To make our peace with pain and suffering while doing everything we can to alleviate it. That's a great challenge. It is the challenge. And to do that and recognize that that is a path of integrity and honesty and reality and joy. And when we do that with others, well, it's just that much more. Flowers fall with our attachments and weeds spring up with our aversion. This is not a mistake. It is not inferior. It is not a problem. How do we live with the whole thing and be dedicated to living a life as an awakened, caring, compassionate, serving being? That's the Buddhist path. And because it's a path, because that can sound daunting, if it doesn't sound daunting, are you listening? It's daunting. But because it is daunting, thank goodness it's a path. If you want to climb up a tall mountain, standing on the ground, looking at a picture of it, thinking about it, can look overwhelming. How could you possibly? But you're not climbing. The moment we start climbing, all of those thoughts, those projections, those speculations, they start to fall away because you are here. You're on that path of when all dharmas. So, I hope for those of you here with us for the weekend, thank you for coming and throwing yourself into it, engaging in all of this. I hope it was helpful to you. I hope that as you head back to your place, that whatever about this, right, is clarifying for you or is inspiring or guiding, offers some guidance in terms of what you are doing, where you're headed, that you take that with you and put wood on that fire. Tend to it. Keep it alive. That's what we need right now. The world is never reducible to one person, to one party, to one government, to one action. It is much bigger than that. Everything is impermanent. We don't know how anything works out. But we have today. We have this. So, how do we put that to good use?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.